Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. In this interview, you're going to get the address of a website for a parliamentary disability committee that wants your input on implementation of equity for people with disabilities. So pick up a pencil now. I won't ask you again. Disrespect introduces Sam Sansalone, the father of four children, one of whom is disabled. We're here to follow up on Katya, who is, what, nine now, Sam?
She's almost nine. Will be this month.
How's she doing, and how are you doing?
Well, she's doing quite well for what she's dealing with. I mean, she has over 40 things that she's followed for.
Okay.
None of them life-threatening, though. Life-threatening or particularly problematic at the moment. But she's enjoying herself and growing up and learning things. And despite her profound cognitive disability, as they would define it, there's no question that this is a person with quality of life.
Do you have her pictures posted?
There are a few websites that have asked for photographs. I think Pro Woman Pro Life.
Okay.
.org organization has a photograph of her up. There's some, I think, on a Facebook group, Faces of Trisomy, I think it's called. I haven't really gotten around to
tracking it down.
Together as I probably ought to, because one of the reactions I get is surprise when people realize that a child with full trisomy 13 can be such a happy, smiling, interactive, socially in your face, great little kid kind of person.
I've seen pictures of able kids without cognitive difficulties who look a lot less happy than Katya.
She's one of the happiest people I know.
Yeah, okay. You and I are both concerned about her potential access and past access, as we've expressed in previous interviews, to medical care. And this is something that's come out recently in Toronto with baby Kaylee Vitelli, as
right.
Well.
Well, I think the operative word is really baby. Access to care for Katya is quite good now.
Okay.
It has been for years, mostly. Not in every respect, but in most aspects.
I think you mentioned to me Katya has been denied access to hearing and visual therapies, Sam.
They're not about to deprive children older than infancy of basic life-saving services.
That's
something they do to the infants generally.
They attain medical personhood if they survive infancy in a practical sense.
I guess it's a lot easier to dehumanize a human that is just out of birth and has questionable prospects, whether they're real or imagined or made up. When you've got a smiling 8-year-old that comes into your hospital room with a big smile on her face and gives you a hug, it's going to be harder to dehumanize the behavior.
Okay.
She's done this to almost everyone. It's interact positively with anybody, even the people who were in reality her enemies in her didn't want her to live and have access to the life-saving surgery that she needed and some other important interventions.
Yeah. Okay. What did you think of that article in the July 3rd Post, the front page, and I think it was pages something like 5, 6, and 7 on baby Kaylee. I haven't had a chance to read it all yet. I was impressed with the amount of coverage and the implicit protection that provides for the baby, but I was a little less impressed with the post's appetite for a challenging critical comment.
Yeah, well, good point. I think that was my reaction. It was very long, which is not a problem, but made me think of tactics we've seen in other areas of civil rights. I wanted to make a reference to Martin Luther King Jr.
Mm-hmm.
He's an example of how the dynamics work mm-hmm. when a civil rights movement is gaining momentum.
Yeah.
And it's an important movement, mm-hmm. and it's threatening people and influence or power in a way that they want to prevent. And, you know, it's there when you think about the allegations of adultery that Martin Luther King had to contend with, that, my understanding is that that came out of a situation where I think it was J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, had been suspicious about communists
right.
Being involved in this movement, and they made some conclusion that there was a danger of communist infiltration. I don't know if it was strategically presented that way, but that enabled the FBI to focus their investigation on the person instead of the issue, and they sought to discredit him.
Yeah.
They made, you know, these determinations from their investigation that he had all these extramarital affairs and was a womanizer or whatever. And there are a number of people who joined.
Yeah.
They're the purveyor of that, and I don't think it ended up helping the bad guys in the end, but it still is an example of how when they're desperate, they'll resort to ad hominem. They'll attack the person instead of the issue because they're uncomfortable with how the issue is being discussed, because it's not in their favor. The truth
right.
is coming out. The moral realities are being exposed, and it's affecting people in power in a way that they don't want it to be affecting
okay.
them. And so when I see in a National Post where five bloody pages are dedicated to, was it five pages? I saw on the internet. I was stunned by the length.
Yeah.
Are dedicated to much of it's knocking down a person or focusing on a person's flaws.
Yeah.
This person doesn't represent the civil rights movement.
No.
He's a father of one of the gazillions of children who are affected
yeah.
by this. Why would a national paper choose to dedicate pages of, you know, prime newspaper space to this story when the real story is underneath that, or above that, I should say,
yeah.
and it's about the civil rights being crushed
right.
From people in positions of authority and power down on what are probably the most vulnerable who have been born.
So you saw it as a negative article?
Because they detracted from what the main point
was. Oh, I see. Misleading in that sense,
yeah.
then.
It's taken attention from a very important social message and issue, what is actually a civil rights movement, and put the spotlight on the flaws of one of the people who's kind of just happens to be involved, that is easy to poke fun at because of his background. And this is someone who I think is being treated unfairly on a personal level, as well as his family
mm-hmm.
being treated unfairly. There's so much of substance to talk about in this Kaylee story. Focus on the political issues, the medical issues, the medical ethical issues, the civil rights issues. I mean, Kaylee's one child out of innumerable children who have had a question about their treatment in the
yeah.
medical system, if it was equitable or if there was inequitable rationing going on.
Right.
So on one baby is a mistake.
Right.
And then to make an even bigger focus of a parent's flaws is, frankly, silly. It's a bit embarrassing.
Yeah.
That's the best. Is that the best Canada can do in its media and use in a time of great need of social movement and improvement?
Yeah.
I think we're capable of better than that. I see here an opportunity to discuss a very important social issue, you know, a civil rights issue. I put out a challenge to them. How about 5 pages on the real issue, the big issue, that this is just a tiny part of, the Kaylee story is just a tiny part of. How about digging your fingers into the reams of stories and evidence that there is a serious problem going on.
All right.
That is producing a great travesty of justice,
yeah,
against a very vulnerable segment of our population. Do that. Give us a big piece of substance to really work with at the public level, to learn, so that we're inspired to learn more about it, we're inspired to think more about it, and to do something about it.
Good idea.
And let's give the politicians something to realize of what's on the agenda in the coming years.
Okay.
You know, from the public, if the public knew everything that there was to know about what happens behind closed doors of Hospital for Sick Children, there would be a lot of outrage. It's an amazing facility for its accomplishments and for the good it does. My daughter's a recipient of that goodness, but she's also been a target of a very dark segment. A minority of the people there are not pursuing everything with the right standards that are expected of them from the people that surround the hospital and believe in the hospital. When she was refused cardiac surgery,
yeah,
I've met with Mary Jo Haddad, the CEO. I was assured that these issues I've raised are of serious concern and that they were going to address them.
Right.
And, you know, within 3 years, Annie Farlow was dead, likely of a fentanyl, intentional fentanyl overdose. I met with them. I described the problems. They accepted a lot of what I was saying, if not all of it. I was given assurances in writing as an after result of that meeting, and I haven't seen those assurances put into practice. Mary Jo Haddad, you know, she recently won Order of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a very high-profile person. I would.
She could be stripped of it if what you were saying is proven.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. I mean, this is a matter that's relating to one of the forefront of of civil rights in our time in society. The use of withholding means to prevent the ongoing life of a baby on grounds of their being disabled is a pretty serious thing to be having in a civilization. And if they only knew what was really going on.
And now for a short break with Tampa Red. Can't get that stuff no more.
You know, Bootleg Sal used to live across town. The law went down and it closed her down. Now you can't get the stuff no more. Now you can't get that stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. You know that place on Dago Hill. The law took the gal and the liquor still. You can't get that stuff no more. Now you can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. Thank you. Suzanne, she used to sell hair grease. She got in trouble with the chief police. Now you can't get the stuff no more. Now you can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. There go Joe with a great big knife. Somebody been messing around with his wife. Now he can't get the stuff no more. He can't get the stuff no more. No matter how he tries, he can't buy, he can't get that stuff no more. Listen. Give it away, but now you can't get it if you offer to pay. You can't get that stuff no more. You can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. All of the gals used to walk the street. The law done run them off his beat. Now you can't get the stuff no more. You can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. I play. You can't get the stuff no more. You can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more.
You've been listening to Father Sam Sansalone talk about the moral implications and the practical problems of two standards of care for children with disabilities at Sick Children's Hospital in Toronto and hospitals across Canada. You've been listening to Father Sam Sansalone talk about the moral implications and the practical problems of two standards of care for children with disabilities at Sick Children's Hospital in Toronto and hospitals across Canada.
I guess babies like Kaylee or my daughter Katya or others who are in the category of severe cognitive disability, I think, unfortunately, they're just viewed as not having contributory value to society because they'll be seen as drawing resources instead of contributing on a fiscal basis.
Well, it's odd. I'm a high-functioning person with a disability, high-functioning in the sense that I can do most things that I want, but I just can't do as much of them as someone who is able. And when I became disabled, my whole perception of people with disabilities changed, and it didn't matter what their disabilities were. I can't go back there. I can't go back to that place where I was before, but I probably subscribe to the popular view that this is a different group. We are us, and they are them, and it certainly marginalized them in my mind that they just weren't relevant to my day-to-day experience. And now, of course, I meet people with all kinds of disabilities, and I don't know. It would be a lie to say that I'm more interested in them than able people, but I am interested in them in a different way and to a different depth. And the thing that changed it was my becoming disabled. So the perception of disability as something that doesn't impair personhood is the awakening that needs to happen.
Well, I'm thinking the general public doesn't, you talked about sort of shift in your perspective, and that happens with your experience of getting right into the, you know, shoes of someone who's experiencing some of these issues.
Yeah.
Most people, until they're very old anyway, will not be disabled.
Right. I like to joke that then they'll wonder why nobody pays any attention to them until they catch a glimpse of themselves in the mirror and remember the way they treated people when they were able.
Well, like has been well put, if you live long enough, everyone becomes disabled.
If you're lucky. If you're lucky, you become disabled.
Right, including to the point where you're not functioning in the way that would be considered optimal by maybe the average person and contributing to the...
Yeah.
Gross domestic product in some way.
Yeah. I wouldn't put that as a measure of personhood, but it seems to be
I agree, too.
It seems to be driving the agenda to recognize and respect people with disabilities. There's a landmark case coming before the Supreme Court involving two people who applied to work at Carnival Cruises and both were turned down. And Carnival Cruises is dead in the water. And it's going to change the way the law is applied to people with all disabilities.
Well, ignorance is, I think, one of the pervasive factors that just perpetuates this whole problem. There's not ignorance, for instance, in the case of situations like my daughter's at the hospital as a neonate facing, you know, life-threatening withholding of treatment. That's not well-known in the public, but it's really quite well-known in the people that know in the neonatology field, for instance. It's mm-hmm. not. I remember that, going back to that article you asked me about, the National Post, July 3rd,
I think it
was an article. I did read it. I think I read the whole thing, and I remember being struck by one comment in particular. It was something about one of the doctors saying that they don't kill children at the hospital for sick children.
Right.
And it's laughable to anyone who knows what really goes on there.
Yeah.
The NICU is very much involved in killing children who don't meet certain criteria. This is not something that that is unknown in the field.
Yeah.
It's unknown to the general public. The question is, how were they killed and what are the reasons and what do they feel can be justified and what cannot be
mm-hmm.
justified, and where all these occurrences happen, because they're happening behind closed doors, we don't have the usual value of public scrutiny to keep these guys in check about, you know, the moral aspects of the decisions. And there's so many different factors that can come into play here, and it's very complicated, true, but the result is that some kids are being killed. There's no question about that. If you know how NICUs work, there are some kids who are being deprived of life intentionally when a decision is made.
Not to provide them with supports.
Yeah. And that's the passive side. There's evidence and knowledge, not just evidence. There's clear knowledge. Again, you'd have to interview the right people if they're willing to disclose this, but there is knowledge that's done actively as well. There are means to precipitate the death of an infant in very simple ways, especially if they have complicated clinical status. There's a lot that could be done, and it's used. So it's a bit laughable that they would make that kind of a statement. It's just going on the internet hearing. Yeah, the words are, we don't kill children at the hospital for sick children. I'd love to see the CEO, Mary Jo Haddad, sign an affidavit, swear that those exact words. We don't kill children at the hospital for sick children. I would challenge her to do that.
Yeah.
I would challenge her. If I was in the media, instead of writing five pages about a personality that is a red herring, really, to the issues that even that personality is trying to bring public awareness about, I would write five pages about something like that.
Yeah.
Does the hospital for sick children kill children? Get one of the executives to put that in an affidavit. I'd love to see it, because if that's in an affidavit, in a sworn statement, a lot could be done with that. There are some people, including myself, who could move on that and show that it's not true.
Okay. Well, you've been very blunt today, and you may yet get your chance. Let's look on the positive side, though. It needs to be challenged. It needs to be stated bluntly. And maybe student and community radio is the place to do it.
I guess there are a lot of forums where this could be pursued. I actually like the idea of what you just described. This other one that I mentioned to you, one of many that are in the works, this parliamentary committee. I really am curious to know what's going to come out of that. They're investigating disability issues in the country, and in their words, Canada is proud to be considered an inclusive society, respectful of every individual. That's how it starts. Now, sure, we have a really advanced inclusive society implementations, but we're far short of optimizing that. Otherwise, organizations wouldn't exist, like the Canadian Association for Community Living or the Alberta Association for Community Living or other like groups.
Euthanasia prevention.
Right, there you go. There are a number of advocacy groups that are in place because Canada, like other countries, is not an inclusive enough society and not respectful enough of every individual. But I appreciate the humility that this parliamentary committee is approaching this with, at least on their website. Here I'm reading it right from their website. As a signatory to the 2006 UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, we recognize that disability issues are a question of fundamental human rights. Despite positive public statements, questions remain about implementation. I was so impressed to see that on a government page, that sentence. Despite positive public statements, questions remain about implementation. It was a real little ray of hope to see that acknowledgement and humility.
Yeah.
And then they go on to say that concerns have been expressed about the devaluation of persons with disabilities. Questions have been asked about health care delivery to people with disabilities. I mean, this is the very issue we're talking about. That my daughter had encountered that baby Kaylee Vitelli. I hope they're doing this with the utmost of sincerity and intent, and that they're not going to be crushed, you know, behind the scenes in this mandate. They're saying we intend to explore the real life situations of persons with disabilities and seek information concerning their full inclusion and equality in relation to the needs that exist in healthcare. This is just a fantastic mandate and project. They're inviting public dialogue so that they can investigate this and do something about it. I'm not aware of something quite like this happening in other neighboring countries anyway. There are always things along these lines, but this is a really formal, official plan and implementation that, if they're successful, I'm just gleeful with the prospects.
Where can a listener see this announcement? Got a web address?
I received it from a mail list that I'm on. That I got. There were a few things announced. This was one of them.
Oh, okay.
Here's an email at. Here's a web address. www.pcpcc- Oh boy, this is long. do you want me to spell the whole thing phonetically? www.peterCharlie.ca/index _files/page823.htm So I think what might help is if you just Google Parliamentary Committee on Palliative and Compassionate Care.
Do you want me to
repeat that?
There's probably a listener who would be glad if you did.
Okay, www.peterCharlie.ca /index_files/page823.htm And all those Peters were obviously, I'm just spelling phonetically. The P was for Peter, the C for Charlie, the S for Sierra.
Okay. What else was there that you wanted to say in summation of what we've talked about? We've talked about disability. We've talked about medical access for people with disabilities, particularly the very elderly and the infants in society. Almost seems to be a new definition of personhood needed. You know, you'd think that the Charter of Rights would be enough. You know, but it doesn't seem to be.
Well, I'm not sure if it's not enough, but it could be helpful. I mean, the way I tend to think of it is when someone is an individual and they're human, that's a person.
End of story. Yeah.
I don't know that I could. It would be walking on very shaky ground, both, you know, denotatively and morally, I think, to try to deviate from something that simple. But it, what's big in my mind right now, I think, is the fact that this is really just an extraordinary opportunity. If people in the media and people in positions of influence and power, whether it be in government or in healthcare or in social rights, civil rights, this is one of the next frontiers in the development of civil rights in human society. It really is, because you tend to have civil rights issues and conflicts develop when there's a vulnerable group being taken advantage or mistreated by a powerful group. And nowhere that I know of is, in at least in the post-birth context, nowhere that I know of is there more of a differential in power and vulnerability than when you're putting a disabled baby with severe cognitive disability, who's just a neonate, easy to kill at that point, when you put them in a society that's strapped for cash and resources and does have, you know, acknowledged problems about devaluing these kinds of these children that have a great disability. So when you have that much of a differential and you don't have the usual strengths in the vulnerable group, for instance, in the African American movement of civil rights in the U.S., they had a fight for decades, and yet these were people that were very capable of contributing in great ways to society,
and did
even in a fiscal basis.
And
so they had that advantage compared to these kids. Another advantage they had is that they had their own voices. These kids don't have their own voices for advocacy.
That's true.
They rely on parents and concerned citizens who are going to make an effort in their lives to put time and effort aside to advocate on their behalf. So that's another disadvantage that the current group has. And another disadvantage is that it's this discrimination, almost all of it gets to happen behind closed doors, you know, in the dark corners of hospital, so to speak, where not only is almost nobody looking, but almost nobody is permitted to look, even trying to involve the police in some of the incidents that occur in hospital is quite a challenge, if not impossible in most cases.
Yeah.
So
I need a clear mandate for these kids and these elderly.
I would say think about the opportunity here. There's a civil rights movement going on. It's a much smaller number, and it's much more vulnerable than other civil rights movement groups have had to work with in the past. And you want a challenge in your life that's going to add meaning to our society? Look into this. You'll be surprised, shocked by what you find. And by fixing this, you know, very specific civil rights problem, you will actually be bettering humankind on a much larger context, because a society that is capable of doing what our society is doing to these kids in the NICUs and the neonatology intensive care units of hospitals, a society that is capable of doing that and tolerating it and hiding it and
rationalizing it
unchecked, that's a dangerous society, not just for those kids, but for
everyone,
for the spinoffs of that.
Yeah. Who was it? I forget his name, the cardinal who was famous for saying, you know, when they came for this group, I didn't say anything, it didn't involve me. And when they came for that group in Germany in World War II, you know, I didn't say anything. And when they came for the Jews, you know, there wasn't much I felt I could do. But when they came for me, there was nobody left to protest. You know? I forget his name. It's a famous quote. Okay. Well, I appreciate your time today. It's more time than we intended to spend, but it's been very fruitful. Thanks for your time. And, we'll be in touch again soon.
Sure. Nice to talk to you again.
All right. Thanks, Sam. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Father Sam Sansalone talk about the moral implications and the practical problems of two standards of care for children with disabilities at Sick Children's Hospital in Toronto and hospitals across Canada. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the stories that we read to you, but abridgments of the stories, condensations from the articles in the papers that we name on the show. First, the Globe and Mail, Monday, August 2nd. Healthcare by Anne Marie Tobin. Poverty increases chances of dying of cancer, study finds. Cancer patients from poor neighborhoods have a greater chance of dying prematurely than their wealthier counterparts, says a new study describing a problem that persists despite universal health care in Canada. Much of the literature on the topic, especially in the United States, has partially explained this disparity by saying it's due to the fact that poor people are diagnosed when their cancer is at a later stage. But this particular study of Ontario patients didn't find that to be the case. It means researchers in the medical community need to be looking at what other reasons might be at play, said Heather Chappell, director of cancer control policy at the Canadian Cancer Society. There is still a survival disparity, and we need to work to understand why that is the case and to correct that difference in outcome, agreed lead researcher Christopher Booth of the Queen's University Cancer Research Institute. The study was published online Monday in Cancer, a journal of the American Cancer Society. Using the Ontario Cancer Registry to identify patients diagnosed from 2003 to 2007, the study shows the chance of a woman from a poor community being alive 5 years after diagnosis of breast cancer is 77%, compared with 84% for affluent women, Dr. Booth said. 52% of patients with colorectal cancer from the lowest socioeconomic groups are alive 5 years after diagnosis, compared with 60% of those in the most affluent communities. These are important and meaningful differences, Dr. Booth said in an interview from Kingston. If we had a form of chemotherapy or cancer treatment that led to an improvement or difference in 5-year survival of 7, 8, 9%, the order of magnitude we're seeing with these differences, it would be a blockbuster home run as far as cancer treatment advances. In a story we told from the Star side last week, this is The Globe, Andrew Picard, public health reporter. A changing epidemic, Canada's AIDS rate on the rise. Intravenous drug users, immigrants, and natives affected disproportionately. The number of annual cases of HIV/AIDS in Canada has risen back to 1982 levels, which is when the epidemic began ravaging the gay community. But those being infected today are increasingly intravenous drug users, Aboriginal people, and immigrants in Canada. An epidemiological shift illustrated by the fact Saskatchewan is now the hotbed of HIV/AIDS in Canada, delegates at the International AIDS Conference heard. The Minister of Health, Don McMorris, said in a written statement that Saskatchewan has allocated $2.5 million to a 3-year HIV/AIDS strategy, and it will target those high-risk groups. HIV and AIDS is a very serious issue for our province, he said. It's vital that we work collaboratively with First Nations and Métis and health and community-based partners. This issue needs to be addressed on many levels, said Stephanie Strathdee, Associate Dean of Global Health Sciences at the University of California, San Diego. While the patterns of HIV/AIDS have changed notably, this response has not. I'm a proud flag-waving Canadian, but I'm ashamed that the Canadian National AIDS strategy has withered, she said. We can and should do better. Her views were echoed by Ron Rosine, vice chairman of the Canadian Treatment Action Council, who said, "We have developing world conditions in pockets of our country, and it's reflected in our AIDS statistics." He said domestic spending on HIV/AIDS has been cut back to about $74 million a year, so we don't have the money to engage in targeted prevention programs. Infections are rising steadily in Canada while they've leveled off in the U.S., Dr. Strathdee said. What Canada and the U.S. have in common is a remarkable drop in deaths since the introduction of antiretroviral drugs in 1996. Another common trait in Canada and the United States is how the impact of the epidemic has shifted to poor minority communities. Inequities are clear drivers of the epidemic, Dr. Strathdee said. These include inequities of race, ethnic group, gender, sexual orientation, and immigration status. All this translates into unequal access to prevention and care, she said. U.S. President Barack Obama unveiled a comprehensive strategy to fight HIV/AIDS in the United States. The plan promises to reduce infections by 25% in 5 years and increase the number of infected people who are aware of their HIV-positive status and those who are treated. Canada's strategy does not have hard targets for reducing the number of HIV infections. And in Toronto, St. Michael's Hospital has made the most dramatic reductions in emergency room wait times, 61%. Tanya Talaga at the Queen's Park Bureau and the Toronto Star, 10-hour wait in ER touted as success. Critics derided the province's expansion of a program to drive down emergency room wait times after Health Minister Deb Matthews touted a 10-hour wait at St. Michael's Hospital as a success story. The province will invest $100 million to increase the number of hospitals in the pay-for-results program from 46 to 71, Matthews announced at St. Michael's Thursdays. The 71 hospitals aim to improve wait time performance by 15% over the course of the year. About $60 million will be used to hire more emergency room staff, high-tech investments to improve patient flow, and for renovations. The remaining $40 million is an incentive fund to reward hospitals that show improvement. Under the program launched in 2008, St. Michael's has reduced emergency room wait times by 16.7 hours to about 10 hours for patients who need complex medical help or a hospital bed, and by 4.6 hours for those with minor conditions. 2 years ago, St. Michael's had one of the longest wait times in the province at over 26 hours, Matthews said, calling the hospital a leader in wait time reduction. I'm delighted you've been able to drive those wait times down to under 10 hours. While wait times are coming down in some hospitals, they're still too high overall, said Progressive Conservative MPP Lisa McLeod, Nepean Carlton. I heard the minister say waiting under 10 hours is a success, she said. I can tell you from speaking with constituents, they think that is unsuccessful and unworkable for them. New Democrat MPP Francis Gélinas Nickelbelt said celebrating a 10-hour emergency room wait is disrespectful to Ontarians. Conservative Lisa McLeod added, the reality is 10 hours for anyone in Ontario is ridiculous. Any parent with a child, like myself, knows 10 hours is too much. Information on surgical and ER wait times online can be found at www.ontario.ca/waittimes. We'll take a short break here with Rocket 88 and Pete Johnson. from the Toronto Star, Andy Frame. Why you pay so much for hydro? Taxes, new charges, and profit-taking have added millions of dollars to Ontarians' electricity bill. Under the old Power Corporation Act, Ontario Hydro had paid no corporation taxes or dividends. Instead, the Ontario government issued Ontario Hydro bonds and collected a guaranteed rate of return from Hydro. It also charged Ontario Hydro and private power companies a water use fee for power generated on Ontario rivers. Ontario Hydro paid a fee to support the Niagara Parks Commission as well. In 1998, those three costs totaled about $180 million a year. Under new legislation, there were 10 new charges that cost Hydro users at least $1.5 billion on their hydro rates. Corporation taxes paid by OPG and Hydro One. Dividends paid by OPG and Hydro One to their shareholder, the provincial government. Corporation taxes paid by local distributors. Dividends paid by local distributors to their shareholders. Costs of operations of the Ontario Energy Board, previously a provincial expense. Cost of operating the Ontario Power Authority, a new agency. Cost of subsidizing wind power and solar power generation through the Global Investment Fund, now about 4 cents per kilowatt hour, hidden in your hydro rate. The GST, although not the PST. Tax on lands held by OPG and Hydro One, not including land used for transmission or distribution lines. Previously, Ontario Hydro had paid property taxes only on buildings. Decommissioning fund and used fuel fund for nuclear plants. On top of these, the McGuinty government has added a new set of costs and charges to hydro customers' bills. Effective May 1st, a special service charge to pay for conservation and renewable energy programs. An increase of 9% on energy generation rates to replace lost industrial revenue. The HST, 13%, replacing the GST at 5%. Increase in the Global Investment Fund charge to pay for new windmill and solar power programs operated by the Ontario Power Authority. Smart meter program. Some may save under this program if they can manage their load, but estimates are a 10% increase for most customers. There is no accurate summary of what the extra costs add up to, but the best estimate is about $2 billion. Changes in rates have been driven by the decision to shut down coal plants and replace power supplies with green energy sources, as well as the need for revenue to deal with the provincial deficit. Adam Beck, the founder of the electric power system in Ontario, would have been appalled. Retail customers are paying much higher rates, but the real damage is to the industrial sector, which was built on low power costs and made Ontario the economic engine of Canada. Adam Beck's ideal of power at cost is gone, and it's clear that we can't go back to the old system, but the dangers of the current approach to the Ontario economy are obvious. Said Dr. Jane Carr, former president of the Ontario Power Authority, current policies reflect public concern about global warming at the expense of securing a stable and economic energy future. If such publicly popular but economically unsound policies continue, the province's prosperity will be seriously jeopardized. And from the National Post, by Shannon Carey, customers on hook for hydro suit. Class action suit won reduction of late payment fees. The customers of Toronto Hydro are going to be asked to pay a special fee to cover the nearly $8 million cost of settling a class action lawsuit over illegal late fees previously charged by the utility. We intend to seek recovery, said Toronto Hydro spokeswoman Denise Atala. That is all I can tell you. That is all I can confirm, she said. The special fee, which must be approved by the Ontario Energy Board, works out to more than $11 for each of the 690,000 Toronto Hydro customers. Toronto Hydro and every other municipal electric utility in Ontario were defendants in a lawsuit filed on behalf of anyone who had been a customer since 1981. The utilities used to charge late fees between 5 and 7% per month. The Supreme Court of Canada ruled in 1998 that this could violate the maximum 60% annual interest rate allowed under the Criminal Code. in a lawsuit against Consumers Gas, now Enbridge Incorporated. The company was found to be unjustly enriched from the late fees. As a matter of public policy, a criminal should not be allowed to keep the proceeds of his crime, wrote Justice Frank Iacobucci. Toronto Hydro reduced its late fee to 1.5% per month in 2000. Within 2 years, all other utilities in the province switched to the same rate late charge. As part of the settlement, the utilities agreed to pay a total of $17 million, of which $7.75 million is the estimated share for Toronto Hydro. While Toronto Hydro declined to explain why the cost of the lawsuit should be passed on to customers, its public filings indicated it expects to gain regulatory approval. The utility believes the Ontario Energy Board will allow such future recovery, it wrote in its first quarter financial statements this spring. Gord Garland, a Toronto economist who initiated the lawsuit against Enbridge, was unsuccessful in an appeal to the provincial government to overturn the decision of the Energy Board in a case in which Enbridge was permitted to pass on more than $25 million in costs to settle a lawsuit over its late fees. The lead lawyer representing the customers in the Toronto Hydro lawsuit was unavailable for comment. And from the Toronto Star, John Spears, business reporter, hydro utilities warn of price shock. Electricity costs to soar 16% on next round of bills as generating firms' fees rise and HST kicks in. An electricity price shock is about to hit, and local hydro utilities are warming up a campaign to tell consumers it's not their fault. Householders who haven't locked in a rate through a retailer can expect to see the price of power jump by up to 16% when their next bill arrives. On top of that, this summer's hot weather is driving up the amount of electricity that many households are using. Utilities like Toronto Hydro and Powerstream are already busy getting the message out to consumers that higher bills are on the way. And the Electricity Distributors Association, which represents local hydro utilities across the province, is sending information packages to members this week advising them how to explain the price jumps as customers open their bills. Brian Bentz, who chairs the association, said the next round of electricity bills consumers receive will factor in two big price hikes. First, the price of power paid to generating companies went up May 1st. That will push a typical household's bill up by 8% unless it has a fixed price contract, Bentz said. Second, the HST is applied to electricity bills from July 1st on, which will push bills up another 8% for all electricity users, whether they have fixed price contracts or not. The price increase will show up as bills go out in the upcoming months. Local utilities are trying to point out that most of the money goes to generating companies, a little over half the bill. Transmission companies like Hydro One and for regulatory charges, including the leftover debt from the old Ontario Hydro. A household using 800 kilowatt hours a month pays just over $100 for electricity, so the price increases and the HST will push bills up about $16 for those on a market rate. And in the kind of good news we wish we didn't have to hear, judge certifies Huronia class action. From the Globe, a judge has formally certified a $1 billion class action lawsuit alleging systemic abuse and neglect of former residents of Ontario's largest institution for people with developmental disabilities. The institution, which first opened as the Aurelia Asylum for Idiots in 1876, held 2,600 people at its height in 1968. For decades, the provincial government, which operated Huronia Regional Center, was accused of ignoring widespread allegations of abuse and neglect. The province has not yet filed a statement of defense in the case. That's the news this week for Disrespect. Come back next week. You know, there will be more. And going out, Muddy Waters. Trouble No More.
I don't care how long she gone. I don't care how long she stay. Good kind treatment. Go bring her home someday. But someday, baby, you ain't no trouble for me anymore.
won't bet, that the dice won't pass. Well, you know, darling, you are living too fast. But someday, baby, you ain't gonna trouble for me anymore. I'm gonna tell everybody in your neighborhood, you're a sweet little girl, you don't mean me no good. But someday, baby, you ain't gonna trouble for me anymore. No more trouble.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.